Feminism isn't just for women. Creating an equitable society requires buy-in from those favored by power imbalances. And in many ways, long-term change relies on conscientious child-rearing to break generational cycles. So I'm very pleased to introduce today's guest. Writer, journalist, and professor Sonora Jha is the author of How to Raise a Feminist Son, Motherhood, Masculinity, and the Making of My Family. Welcome, Sonora.
Thank you for having me, Shannon.
This book is both a memoir and a manual. Instead of me summing up for the audience what this book is about, why don't you put it into your own words?
Sure. So I like to see it as a love letter to the next generation of men, sort of coming from this place as a mother writing about her experiences raising a son and looking at the challenges where I'm from in India, and then looking at the challenges of that also in the US, and sort of a conversation with other parents, with just anyone in society that has any influence on the way men are raised, and asking them to do better, to let boys be tender-hearted and soft and gentle and not get snatched up by toxic masculinity, and how to go about that. So I share how I did it, and I share what can be done beyond what I did.
The book is also deeply personal, not only from your own experiences, but also when it comes to your son, Gibran. I'm curious what his active input was as the book was being written.
That's a great question. So, he's a young adult now, and he was terribly embarrassed, of course, because he doesn't want to be the feminist son. And, but he was also, I think he's deeply, deeply proud of me somewhere deep inside. But he's asked to be sort of out of the limelight. He's a very private person. But he helped me with some research, and you'll be delighted to know the document that he started with all the research bits in it was called For Mama's Feminist Book. I love the title of that document, and I'll always have it with me. But yeah, he helped me with some research. He helped me with interviews. He introduced me with some of his friends. To get their perspectives. And every time I called and I said, hey, I need to ask you a couple of questions about something that I'm trying to remember about our life together. And, he would quickly jump in and give me whatever he could.
What are some very intentional aspects of his upbringing that went into raising him as a feminist?
Yeah, I start the book with this essay on raising a feminist at the movies, right? That we would go to the movies. It was just like this thing that we had to do every weekend. It was almost like a biological need, And it ended up being a really good place to have conversations, or good source of conversations, because we would talk about how women were represented in the movies and what was driving the plot and how much time women got and what their representation was, et cetera, and what their driving purpose was in the movies. And we'd recognize that, oh my goodness, women don't get a good deal at the movies. And then him also watching me enjoy the movies and what did I like, and, just sort of looking at all those things, that the conversations that we needn't have had or may not have had directly, because I'm not saying things like lesson number one, lesson number three in feminism, right? We didn't really use the word feminism, but in everyday things like the movies and like food, like conversations around dating and everything, we were doing it with a feminist lens, because I was sharpening my own feminist lens as we went along, and sort of giving him one to look at the world.
And in that scene in the movies, you mentioned that when you would go to consume just popular culture, specifically in the form of movies, that you would apply something known as the Bechdel test. Can you explain what that is to listeners?
Yes, the Bechdel test is this incredible test by this cartoonist and author, Alison Bechdel, who writes about, to know whether a film has done right by women, you need to see if there's more than one woman character. If there are two, are they talking to each other about anything other than men, right? And so when you start to look by that measure, by that test, you find that, wow, there are very few movies in which that is actually happening. So it's a fun thing to do. It can be a little depressing when you see the results, but it's still a fun thing to examine movies by.
Do you have any other just quick tips like that come to the top of your mind that you would recommend to listeners who want to raise a feminist son?
Yeah, I think, if you just start with a sense of like, you're going to make mistakes, you don't have to do it perfectly. That's my first tip, right? You just have to sort of go by instinct. And the main thing is, the main thing is to do it with love and compassion, where boys should be allowed to feel tender, not to say boys don't cry, get over it and things like that. Let them be tender-hearted. Let them be sweet and gentle and hold on to that. And the other few things that I feel are really important is stories. I mean, not just through the movies, but books and nursery rhymes and, depending on the age, kind of be talking about representation and talk about what a male character gets to do versus a female character, et cetera. And then also one important thing that I found is to teach boys to apologize. I think that is such an important thing for them to recognize that it is not the end of the world. They don't have to get things right all the time. They could be wrong. They could hurt people. And to really listen to people, believe women, believe girls, know that they could be saying something that you don't know and you did wrong, and learn to genuinely apologize. I think those things just build a sense of empathy, which is really what is a foundation for a feminist boy or feminist man.
On that point, there's a part that I had dog eared of this book that you cited the Ohio State University's Fisher College of Business Journal of Negotiation and Conflict Management Research, laying out the 6 parts to the structure of an apology. And just, I think this is such a wonderful just piece of insight that it's worth putting out there on the airwaves. 1 is the expression of regret. 2 is the explanation of what went wrong. 3 is the acknowledgement of responsibility. 4, declaration of repentance. 5, offer of repair. And 6, a request for forgiveness.
Yeah. And, I would also add that we don't demand forgiveness, right? If someone is not ready to forgive, you just accept that and apologize anyway. And not demand that. And I think so many people still get it wrong. And the thing is, we haven't expected it from men. I find it myself, even now, I find that I don't expect consequences for men's behavior. And it's been such an exercise to learn that as a woman, that I can demand a consequence, I can expect a consequence. And we're just only now beginning to see that happen. And it's going to be a big, big change for the world.
And it really goes back to how we're hardwired from childhood into what our social expectations are, what we believe will happen, how we're supposed to act. A lot of your book, one overarching theme in it is the work entailed in breaking entrenched cycles. Share a bit about what load that implies just in your day-to-day life of parenting.
Yeah, thank you. It's such a constant thing to learn and unlearn. And you're absolutely right. Like, it's so much is deeply conditioned in me that, so the book is really also, I think that one of the reasons it's resonating with people who are not even parents and, younger women, is that it's about how to live a feminist life, how to sort of retrieve yourself and regather, regroup for yourself and figure out things that were not working, but you were so deeply conditioned to. So one of the reasons that in the subtitle of the book, it's The Making of My Family, is that I had bought into this notion that I'm incomplete, I'm sort of treading water unless I am in a marital setup, right? So trying marriage once and then twice, and then just feeling like such a failure when it didn't work, and not seeing that my son and I are family. We are complete in ourselves and should be considered a family, and that family comes in different ways now. Look at the LGBTQ community and look at all the different iterations of family today. So that's something I've had to learn. I'm not sure I'm completely there yet. I just still sometimes, you know, hesitate before saying my family when referring just to me and my son. And so I think those are the little things that sort of just get in our way, and the ways in which we get in our own way because of our conditioning. And once we start to sort of twist and turn them and topple them, things do get easier and there's much more love, you know, to go around that way.
And as part of this conditioning, you, one of the most personal aspects of your story in this book is just how you were raised, what you grew up seeing, what you grew up experiencing, and even to this day, your relationship with your mother, and how you say that you were brought up to believe that a family was a traditional setup of a man marrying a woman and having children, and that to this very day, your mother regards your first husband as a god. How do you come to terms as an adult, as somebody who has raised a child now and seen everything that is entailed in raising a child? Like, how do you just sit with and digest the way you were raised and some of the beliefs that she still holds?
It's heartbreaking, Shannon. My mother hasn't talked to me since my 50th birthday about 3 years ago, because I wrote an essay in which I called out the violence of my brother and the enabling of the violence by people around him. And so I know that that's painful, but I don't know whether that's worthy of rejection. And so one of the, you know, so I can be fierce around it, but really what it is heartbreaking. And you know, one of the conversations I had with my son around that is, you know, I said, can you picture me taking your side over a sister? So he had a stepsister for a while, but he laughed at it. He said, I think it would be the opposite. I don't think you would stand by me if I had been violent toward my sister. There's no way. And so the only thing I can do is break that cycle, right? Break that cycle of oppression toward women. Break that cycle of disbelief of women's stories. And he sees that. And, you know, one of the, he says to me too that, you know, you were not treated well. I can see that, that your mother doesn't treat you nicely. So I'm so sorry that you have to bear this pain. And he's a young man. And for him to be able to see that, I think the salve for me, or the healing from the pain of my own, you know, from my own mother and my own family, comes when I see that my son is not going to continue that, that he both sees me and is probably going to carry that in his relationship with the women in his life.
And in your particular case, not only were you raising a feminist son, but you were also raising a brown boy in the United States as a single immigrant mother far from your family in India. What social support systems helped you through this?
Oh my goodness, that's such a great question, you know, because it gives me an opportunity to thank all the wonderful people that I have in my community here in Seattle. When I moved to Seattle for my assistant professor job at Seattle University, I didn't know anyone except the chair of the department that had hired me. And now I have an incredible community of feminists and, you know, men, women, everyone, all genders, all ages, all professions. And I just feel so fortunate because I could not have raised my son without their help. And also just coming to this reckoning, sense of reckoning with America and its gaze on black and brown bodies as my boy was growing up, because when he was a kid, he was cute, but recognizing that as he grows into a man, there are some people that are going to see him as a threat or less than in some way. That broke my heart about America, you know, because I was building a life here, was feeling really good about it. And then seeing, you know, that he had the cops called on him by a neighbor when he was trying to get into our home because he had left his keys, you know, as teenagers do, he had forgotten his keys at home. And just feeling the danger of raising my son here. But, you know, both he and I have a lot of humor and a sense of resiliency. And, you know, so we kind of cope with those things and we try and, you know, work with the best of both worlds. And yeah, he's got a good circle of friends that he calls when he's hurting and when he wants to talk about heartbreak and things like that. And I feel like giving him that sense of chosen family and giving him that sense of, you know, people will be there for you and you be there for them has been a really important thing, not to fall back on just family or, you know, your birth family that can betray you and can have distrust with you, but you can build family anywhere you go. I think that's been really lovely for me to learn and for me to pass on to him.
And going back to the issue of family, I think that one of the more surprising aspects of the book was the way you came to terms with your father and the way his behavior changed over the course of time from your childhood to the current day. Just describe how you navigated that and what you feel people's capacity for change is.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the thing that gives me such a lot of hope, that it's possible to change masculinity and toxic masculinity. It's possible because who else could be a better example than my father, who was such a violent man in my childhood. You know, he was a very loving father in many ways. And then he would have these, you know, fits of rage, and there was alcoholism, and, you know, he was in the army, and he's from the Brahmin upper caste in India. So there's a lot of patriarchal casteist violence that exists in India. And that sort of also finds its way into the Indian family or to Brahmin family. And he was violent toward my mother. He was violent toward us kids. And he was just the worst kind of masculinity. And then my brother sort of inherited that violence and turned it on to me and to, even to my sister. And now, after all these years, my father has apologized multiple times to me. And in his apology, he's basically said, you know, that he ended up lonely or estranged from his children because of his violence, and he really, really regrets that. And he, you know, so the part that he doesn't understand is, you know, when I asked him, could the army have had something to do with it, the military, and he said, no, that's a great institution. And, you know, so you recognize that, you know, men are capable of individual change, but sometimes they still trust institutions and will not work for structural change, right? They will not even admit that structurally they've been advantaged, or some structures uphold their violence, uphold their supremacy. And I think that's, you know, that's something that I still need to work on with my father. But he's a very gentle grandfather to my son. And even though my son sees some of the toxic masculinity in the ways, the kind of jokes my father will make and stuff, he could not believe when I told him that my father used to be a violent. He said, no way, he's so mellow. And I was like, yeah, no, that's a difference, you know. So just knowing that my father's changed so much. And, you know, when my book came out in India, this The Feminist Son book, my father said, oh, I want to go get copies and I'll take a picture and I put it on Facebook. And I said, oh, dad, like, there's a chapter in there about your violence. I don't know if you're going to like the book so much. And he said, you know, my violence is a truth, and I'm glad you wrote about it. It's important to write about it. I still want to buy the book and take pictures of it. And I was just, you know, I was speechless. I was just like, look at how far we've come. And that just gives me hope that it's possible, even with grandfathers, leave alone raising feminist sons, you know?
Wow. Wow. In the time that you have seen your son go from a small child to an adolescent to a young adult, at what point did you really have an aha moment of success? I have raised a feminist son.
You know, the jury's still out, right? Like, because he still mansplains to me. Last night, he was mansplaining a movie to me. But you know, I think in his interactions with his friends, I quote one of his friends in the book, Sienna, who talked about how gentle, even in high school and after, that he's kind of understood her point of view and he really listens. He listens to her talk about, you know, feeling self-conscious about her body and saying, oh yeah, I feel the same way. And she says, it's just so strange to hear a straight young man talk like that and to get it, and, you know, instead of dismissing her. And And even the way he calls out some of his friends on their sexist behavior, those are things that I've heard about. And then corrects me. There's, you know, I write in the final chapter about how I was asking him, "Oh, are you flirting with the waitress?" And he explained to me why that was something he would never do because she's a woman at the workplace. And it's just like such a revelation to me, you know, that feminism goes beyond my own teaching or my own sense of what is right and wrong with the feminist lens. And so those are the signs that I see, right? But I'll always have an eye on him, always sort of be looking to see, okay, are you doing okay with feminism, you know? But I think I have raised a feminist son.
And finally, I said that the book is as much a manual as it is a memoir. At the end, you have a series of, you know, reading suggestions or viewing recommendations. Can you just name a few off the top of your head that are really good media to consume along with your son?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. You know, the book Cinderella Liberator is a wonderful book by Rebecca Solnit. It's right at the top of my mind because I was rereading it. It's about, you know, Cinderella sort of rescuing the prince and, you know, and not wanting to head off into the sunset with the prince. Those kinds of books that at a younger age, I think that's a lovely thing to do. But recently, you know, there are a couple of things when we watch movies now, he lives in a different city, but we watch things separately and then sort of talk or text over them. And so he texted me recently to say, "Oh gosh, you have to watch season 4 of In Treatment with Uzo Aduba as the therapist." And it's on HBO. It's a really good show. And I was taking a while to go to it. And he said, "No, drop everything and watch it." And it's such a brilliant, brilliant season. And she, Uzo Aduba, plays a therapist, and she's so remarkably smart and, you know, wonderful. And the fact that my son is drawn to that, right? Drawn to a strong female lead who's not all about romance and is the, you know, is sort of the intellectual in a show, that makes me really happy that he thinks of it as one of the best things on television right now. Those kinds of things which it's not even like, "Oh, that's, you know, because you're a feminist, you're doing this." It's just he's naturally drawn to these things. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, I've given a whole lot of lists of things. And, you know, like he talked to me about Community and the things that he's seeing in there and the way it makes fun of the girl trope or the girl cute, sexy girl kind of thing. You know, he's bringing that lens to it and he's watching things with that humor and that kind of way. He also tells me what's going on social media, you know, like the pickup artists or the men's rights movement, and he'll call me and he'll make fun of that and he'll talk about it, and I'd be like, "Oh my goodness, this is some pretty creepy stuff out there," you know, the incel movement and things like that. So he kind of keeps tabs on that, and sometimes I feel like, "Why are you doing this? Why are you reading that stuff?" And he says, like, "It's really interesting to see how these people think," and, you know. So yeah, we've just made social media and media in general a big point of conversation for us. And, you know, and the values show up in that, you know, the way you're talking about things, the things you're drawn to, the kind of media you love, your values sort of are both reflected and shaped by those.
And you mentioned like the incels and the men's rights and all this stuff going on in social media, but at the same time, you teach at a university level, granted in a city that's known for progressive politics, but do you see a shift in this younger generation?
I do. And I, of course, totally recognize that we could be in a total bubble here in Seattle, you know, but I do see that in my students, that it's kind of seamless for them, you know, that I advise a campus newspaper, and the editor in chief is a young Latina woman. And, you know, the men around her are, you know, they expect her leadership to, you know, as seamless, and it's not made a big deal of, or, you know, and they're learning from her and they don't try to challenge her or mansplain to her. And it's just refreshing, you know, and I don't say like, "Oh, good for you, young men." It's almost just the way they are, you know, so I'm not congratulating them, but they are, definitely a different generation and different ideals, and are not self-congratulatory about that. And so I do see that. Occasionally, of course, you do see a toxic male culture as well. And, you know, academia is full of it. There's a great show right now called The Chair on Netflix that everyone should watch, you know. But I think I have a lot of hope in the next generation. I think they're getting it right for the most part.
I just want to say that I enjoyed not just reading your book for the topic, but the way you write. You have a very nice writing style. It's just a delight to read the witty ways in which you turn a phrase. And so I wanted to ask you, like, who are some of your favorite writers? What's the best thing you've read lately?
Oh, wow. Thank you. Well, one of my favorite writers is Zadie Smith, and I really aspire to have her wit and kind of have the, you know, she writes both fiction and essays, and I'm drawn to her writing, very deeply drawn to her writing. I am right now reading Hanya Yanagihara's book, The People in the Trees, and it's fascinating. It was her first book before her second one, which was A Little Life, that won the Booker Prize a few years ago. I'm absolutely loving that. I've loved Samantha Irby's, both her books. Her second one is called Wow, No Thank You, and I have really loved that. I just read The Other Black Girl by Zakiya Delilah Harris, and also, Raven Leilani's book, Luster. So sort of going between essays and fiction. I'm drawn to fiction. My next book is a novel that's going to be out in early 2023. So I'm kind of delving back into fiction now and just sort of enjoying that.
Thank you for your time. I've kept you quite a while, and I want to ask if there's anything else that you wanted to touch on that I didn't bring up in my questions.
No, I'm good. Thank you. You have you had an exhaustive list of questions, and I really enjoyed this. Thank you for such a deep reading of my book and for getting it.
Well, thank you, Sonora Jha, author of How to Raise a Feminist Son, Motherhood, Masculinity, and the Making of My Family.